Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowery. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we'll sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today we're talking with Christopher Furman. Christopher, thank you for joining us. Let's give the listeners a little bit of background on you as an artist. I guess you could probably start at age one or two, I think, probably, was when you first had your first one-man show. Is that right?
Right. I came out and I immediately started drawing, doing blood drawings. So blood just drawings. A series of blood drawings.
Better than poop drawings,
right,
I always
absolutely.
Say, right?
Did blood drawings and made my first sculpture out of the placenta.
Uh-huh. Placenta sculpture is good.
And it's it was very ahead of its time.
Yes, yes. Yes, it is. And then after that, where did you – I mean, where can you go after that?
I know. It was like – it took me at least 30 years to, like, you know, rediscover my talent.
to figure out what to do next. a short block.
Right.
You know, I don't know. What kind of artist were you? I mean, really, did you come out of the womb as an artist? Were you drawing and painting?
That is such a weird question. Only in sense like
are you calling you come me? Are you saying I'm a stupid person?
I think, this is why we're here, right? Because we're not here to talk about me. We're actually here to talk about how stupid you are.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
No, that whole notion of like you came out and you were dead. You know, you were born an artist. I think is silly. Yeah. I don't think it's the same thing as you know. I think it's something you come into, that you're nurtured into. So, certainly, I had a tendency towards things, and my mom was a very left-wing person, and I was joking with her just last night, and her only disappointment with her family is that no one was gay.
Really?
That's really? How left-wing she was. Like, she's so happy that I'm an artist.
Tell her, hey, Mom, there's always hope. You
right.
know?
I mean, she totally ignores the fact that, you know, like, if you go into being an artist, you're, you know, nobody can ever prepare you for the road you're about to travel because it's going right. to be wrought with, like, financial anxiety. But, you know, So I'd always made mechanical things. I had my first teacher whom actually I'm still in contact with, Kelly St. Clair in seventh grade.
Wow.
So I made like marble things. And
so it's like one of those stories that a seventh grade teacher actually did have an impact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm still in contact, partly because I had the hots for.
Ah.
She had these stunning blue eyes.
Really?
And this mole that was like, right. It was just,
so it was
sort of like your wife.
So it was, yes, exactly.
So it's the hots for her.
So it wasn't about making art at all. It was about sex.
Absolutely.
It all comes back to that.
14-year-old kid, you know, maybe or whatever you are in 7th and 8th grade.
Right. It changes to sex and the not-so-single artist.
Right.
For your wife who's listening here. So anyway, after you got over the mole and the blue eyes.
Right.
And the placenta piece, what happened next?
At some point, somebody put the poison of art in me.
I think
it was Kelly St. Clair.
Yeah.
She said, you know, I showed her something I had made, and she said, oh, that's art. And I was like, well, what's that? And I remember actually my first, the first tool I got was a hot glue gun at the age of 7 or 8. I think my mom was going to do me in early, man.
How many people remember their first hot glue gun out there?
I remember because it was like,
it was
instant. I could instantly build stuff.
Yeah.
You just squirt some hot glue on and next thing everything stick.
Great.
It's not very archival, but I, and Kelly St. Clair said, you're making art. And then I got into making art. And then I moved, for high school, I moved overseas with my father. And continued to make stuff in his shop.
Where were you overseas?
In Rome, Italy.
Ah.
Which was phenomenal. I mean, it really...
And his shop was wood shop, metal shop?
It was a wood shop. It was a dinky. It was like in the garage in an apartment. And we built it together. Albeit most of the time him yelling at me, but it didn't matter because we were building the shop together, you know? And I would trash his tools. Only things a good son would do.
Right.
And then,
but no interest in building furniture per se. It was more interest in.
It's you know it's funny because they were non. That's a good point. That's a good point actually because they were non utilitarian things. I mean,
really?
Most of them were like. I mean, again, in the beginning, it was more like building goofy little things where you would press a button here and it would be a chain reaction of events. And I discovered a motor and I was like, ooh, what's this? You know, and learn how to put stuff. But it was never utilitarian. And my dad was big on utility. I mean, he was like,
so it was. creative for you, really?
It was, for me, it was like, it was a way to get lost.
Yes.
Without using a lot of drugs.
Right.
You know, it was the next best thing, or it was probably better than drugs at that point.
So you'd find yourself getting lost in the process?
Yeah, and it was very, I mean, I would stay up till 3 in the morning.
Right. Isn't that interesting? So many people I've talked to talk about that. Well, they talk about as they mature, being lost in the process, stepping back from the process, being back in your ego, looking at it, making decisions, making changes, getting lost again in the process. Do you find that?
That is real. That is for me why I continue. And lately it's you go into the fog.
Yeah.
And then you come out with an object and you're responding to something. You may not always know what it is. And in fact, if I go into that fog with an objective, I make crap.
Right.
You know? If I just have to go
in.
You got to
get out of the way of the gods.
Right. You know? And it's usually like in those last minute decisions that the best decisions are made. And that whole thing, if you plot it all out, it's real boring. And
right.
And if you just respond to your gut kind of thing, you know. But I'm. You know, the biggest stumbling block is trying to respond to like what you think you're supposed to be responding to, as opposed to just letting it be. And lately, my favorite
things. What do you mean? What you think you're supposed to be responding
like
to?
Like, if
I mean, what the culture tells you should be responding to, what the art world tells you you should. What do you mean?
For me, they're kind of in the same because I'm so, submersed in the art world and that being my culture. So, like, if the latest hot new thing is like, you know, technology and art, then I try to find some piece of technology that I can use within my art to see how it influences it.
Right.
And it just, it's not, I'm not responding to myself. I'm responding to something else.
Right. And that doesn't work for you.
Not for me.
Yes. Interesting.
It's disingenuous.
Uh-huh.
And if I'm going to be, and I've poisoned the well many times doing that.
Yes.
And like I said, I will always build stuff, and it's just like the most honest stuff is like...
Almost every artist I've talked to has talked about that. I mean, I'm starting to see patterns here of, you know, like I was saying, moving into it. Sort of about, why the hell do you do this? You know? And one of it is that being transfixed by the process.
Right.
Being intellectually engaged by the process. Finding a place where you can really be true. This sounds so corny. Really true to yourself, you know? I mean, really pure expression.
Right, and
I mean, where the hell... You can't go to work and do that.
No.
Work is all about not being
That's
mostly...
That's why, like, when I taught this last semester, at one point I would stop around, I'd look at these kids and go, Jesus Christ, you don't get that sitting around and talking about esoteric things that have, like, nothing to do with any function or money, what a privilege that is.
Yeah.
I mean, you check back in the academia once in a while, it's just like...
Right.
I mean, it's just... I was just... When I was talking to Sally downstairs about her paintings, and at one point I'm just like... You know, we're both talking about, oh, I use these patterns to do this and this, and you're just talking about this stuff, and it seems so right at the time, but then when you walk away, you're like, what does that got to do with anything?
Yeah. Well, maybe that's what's so wonderful about it.
Right.
You know, I mean, we're also caught up in
the practicality,
of things, and the money, and the fame, if it happens, or the recognition if it happens, but those are very separate entities that we've allowed to infiltrate, in many ways, a process of art that in many ways our culture doesn't understand.
No, because
and that's kind of what the show is about, to help people sort of, you know, kind of. You know, it's not just a bunch of crazy drunk people, although many of them are.
But not many, but some of them, certainly.
Present company excluded.
Right.
So, you know, it takes tremendous discipline. It takes tremendous courage to keep doing it. You know, you don't get a lot of...
I don't know if it's courage.
Really?
Sometimes there's a certain amount of blissful ignorance. You just turn a blind eye.
Uh-huh.
The less I know, the happier I am, kind of thing.
And really?
In continuing the process, because if you think about it,
I mean, it's a very sort of
it's
zen.
A sinkhole.
What do you mean?
Of money, of time.
Oh yeah, but the less you know, the happier
you are.
Talk about that.
Well, the less I mean, I don't sit there and tally up at the end of the day the amount of hours and you know what my time is worth. I mean, the amount of work it takes me to do a piece. And nobody really buys this stuff, but it's a very cool object, and everybody always responds to it very favorably. So I actually have a better time thinking it in terms of gifts. Like if I make keep somebody in mind, like I'm going to give this to somebody. Sometimes I don't because I actually love the piece. But, you know, I can't sit there and tally up at the end of the day.
So is it really about materials? Is it really about I mean, love has so many different meanings. But is it really about loving, doing what you're doing or God, you know?
That is so – I mean – sometimes it is. Sometimes it becomes about an identity so ensconced that at this point in my life, like, I can't give it up. You know, this is who I am.
Right.
Or it also could become, this is what people tell me who I am. And
right. Have you ever gone through a period where you didn't make art?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there are times when you don't go to the studio for months.
Really?
Because, you know, whatever catches you. And but then you kind of get back into it and things I start going back in the studio when I want to make a nutty little thing, and then I start getting that energy back, and you start getting back into making and going back in and finishing up old pieces, because sometimes you get involved in something that's a big thing. And
well, your work is really interesting. Is there anywhere anybody can see your work on the web?
At www.christopherfurman.com.
All right, so www.christopherfurman. How do you spell it?
F-U-R-M-A-N.
Okay, all right, but let's try the impossible. I don't do this too often, but your work I find so fascinating and so interesting and so interesting to look at. Can you describe any of your work?
I get interested in one component because I don't really think of it in terms of one piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a bunch of pieces more like they're all like these characters. And then I start combining these mechanical objects to build a conical piece.
But so you use a lot of mechanical things, a lot of motors, moving parts,
machine-based. So I built what was called an orrery. Which is nothing more than
an Oreo.
No.
I think this interview is over now. Chris, come back. Chris. Well, folks, it's going to be a long 15 minutes here as I talk about my.
No, an Ori was a 18th century mechanical models they used to describe the solar system. So it would be like a central planet and another planet spinning around it.
What'd you build it out of?
Steel, copper, gear, mostly out of steel. Then I would get the whole thing plated, like nickel plated. So it's kind of.
Is it electrified or is it?
It's an electrical device, and it stands about 5 feet tall. Of course, it's adjustable.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it doesn't necessarily replicate. Like, you know, the sun-earth relationship, because if you were to do that, it would have to be like miles long, kind of
really?
Distance. But it's just, all it does is denote solar system. So there's like a central large steel ball, and then around it there's a planet, and then a moon goes around the spinning planet, and the whole thing spins around. Maybe at this point I had to make it smaller to front in this one area. So it's probably, you know, the diameter that the ball travels is like 36 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So then... So I built that, and you're kind of standing there going, okay, that thing's built. It looks cool. Let's, you know, by itself is not that exciting. So then I built this a gobo, which is for a theater light, which you pass. It's like a small steel plate. You cut lines in it, and you create shadows. So
sure.
But I built a mechanical one. So it was all these moving gears. And so then you could take, and I got this like super powerful ellipsoidal spotlight. And I could take this thing and project it on the side of a building, and it would just be these big moving gears. So what you then do is you project that on the wall, and then you put the orrery in front of it.
Right.
So it sort of becomes about the machine, the mechanized universe as, you know, we see it.
So now you're seeing the machine on the wall. Really?
So you're seeing this projection of
the shadow
gears,
of the machine,
and then there's this planetary.
So the two
together bring on more than just them by themselves.
Right.
Because they begin, there's a conversation.
Right.
You get the two pieces.
Conversation. What do you mean?
Right.
What do you mean?
So then you start building narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You in your head, there's no like, you know, these two objects aren't literally talking, but you in your head start building a narrative, because it's not just this orrery in the middle of a room. Then there's this other element behind it of the mechanized clockwork universe, and that sort of became sort of the notion of like the higher consciousness that we're on. We're sort of everybody's slightly aware, but whether they want to recognize or not recognize that sort of notion in the midst behind this mechanical, physical orrery that we sort of are.
So as you're making these things are revealing certain thoughts, certain perceptions, certain ideas to you. Is that? I mean, you don't start out, like you said earlier, you don't start out saying, I'm going to make something that's going to end up having a conversation about sort of the great unconscious or God or what, you know.
Not really. No. I mean, it kind of, that's where I come from, but, and it ends up being about that, but there's two ways of working, and there's the way of like, okay, I've got this idea, how do I best get to it through the medium I have?
Right.
Or you just start building and it develops to that idea.
Right.
And I work both ways, but most of the time it's like I just want to build this thing, and I build it, and I go, oh, wow, that really talks about my need to understand the relationship. What is this fact that, you know, we have a model of an atom, which is very similar to the model we have of a galaxy or a solar. I mean, these things keep reoccurring. What's that about? I don't have answers, but that's
interesting.
What those aura rays end up being for me.
Huh.
Or I'll build a piece. I built a small orrery and I put it in a steel ball, and by itself wasn't interesting. But I noticed that if I built this TV monitor that looked around that would think about that, that became interesting to me.
If you had a TV monitor, did what? What is this TV monitor doing?
See, to me, in my... my head, it's very clear.
Yeah. No, this stuff is hard to talk about. You know, it's like those things they used to make you do in fourth grade, you know, where you had to like explain a picture to someone, you know, and it was like torture, you know.
It's,
No, I said that thing that looks like a candy cane's on the right, man. You
know? Oh,
the other, your other right, you know.
Oh. It's a, you take a TV monitor,
right?
Or just a TV, and you pull all the plastic away, and you're left with the cathode ray tube.
Right.
And you put it in a gimbal, and you allow it, and you mechanize it, so you have two axes of movement. So it looks like you can
turn. Gimbal is something that's a, sort of a ball, like pivoting?
Well, it's a frame within a frame.
Okay.
So that you have an XY axis. So this thing can move around.
So this thing can move around.
Right. I mean, the funny thing is I'm showing you, but of course it's on radio.
It's on radio. Right. Which is the reason we're both sitting here buck naked. Right. I guess I wasn't supposed to say
right.
that. Welcome to Naked Radio. You know why our listeners tune in?
Because they know.
Because they know we're naked. So anyway, all right, so you got this monitor moving around?
It's a TV. It's a cathode ray tube. So it's the tube, which is all changing because of flash screen. Anyway, it's a cathode ray tube. You give it a personality by causing it to move in a way that somebody's head would be moving if they're looking around.
Okay.
And then
what's on the screen?
See, that's then what do you put on the screen? Right. Because it was like a technical problem I want to go over. And what do you put on the screen? Well, you make it think. So one way you make it think is you put images on it. And one of the images I thought would be cool would be one of these orraries. And so I made a tiny little orrary. Put it in a steel ball and put a camera in there, so it's totally black, and so it would period. You know, you would have static, and then periodically it would poof, this image would pop on the screen via real simple mechanics. So it was like this thing, this, you know, it was almost a sort of a self portrait kind of thing. It was like this mechanical TV looking around. It would stop and think about this orrery.
Right.
And but that orrery is not only just about an orrery.
So what's the website again? www.christopherfurman.com.
www.christopherfurman.
FURMAN.com. Okay.
And you can also see my wedding on the website.
Your wedding?
Yeah. Probably.
Really? Very nice.
Because I told you, see, I don't really like filming more than I like editing. Mm-hmm. So I had like 3 hours of material that I got to edit. So.
Well, how do you feel about, you said your work's not selling?
No.
No.
Not really, no. No. Partly because I don't really, it's like, I don't know. I mean, it used to sell.
It's such extraordinary work. I really am surprised.
Right. Well, I don't.
It is extraordinary. It is also really big, usually.
Right. And it's hard to live with mechanical work. And so, you know, it's.
I remember the one I saw at your place in Chicago. You know, it was sort of going around in a large circle. You have to duck every 15 seconds.
Exactly.
You know?
It's like this big. And that piece was.
Honey, hurry up!
When I did a show with that piece, that was an awesome show because it was in this, it fit in the room just so. So as, and as people were in, you know, specifically at the opening, because that's when most people see the work. But anyway, at the opening, this thing stirred the crowd literally.
Did it really?
Because it would cause people, they would have to either get out of its way or conversations when people would walk and not really, I was watching people and they weren't necessarily like, well, oh, here it comes and duck. They would actually just, they continue the conversation and walk 10 feet and continue and then walk another 10 feet. That piece got torn apart and used for a bunch of other stuff. Because sometimes I'll just recycle because you can't sell 7-foot walking machines.
Where the heck do you store them?
Yeah.
I was talking to a guy about his paintings, and I said, you used to do really big paintings. And he said, yeah. And I said, why do you do small paintings now? He looked at me and he said, ran out of space.
And that's the reality.
It was really true.
And with this sculpture, really, I was telling you, I bought this building in Chicago. It's a storefront, and that's basically sucked most of my life out. But I put a lot of work in. There's a front window display I built specifically to put work in. And then at night, the lights go on. And actually, I do get a lot of – you get these random notes. Like, people will leave notes like, I really like this work. Because it's also in a ghetto.
Right.
So you don't really expect to see this sort of mechanical Tim Burton-looking scientific apparatus.
When someone breaks in and steals one,
that would be a compliment, though. If they went to all that work, because it's not as easy, because there's bars up and all that stuff. So if somebody actually stole the work and they got arrested, I would not press charges.
Maybe you should steal it. After this show's over, I'll tell you how to market yourself, okay?
There you go.
First thing we do is steal your work.
That would be great. Stage of that. They stole my artwork.
Right.
It must be that good.
Right. It must be that good. And then have the artwork, end up being the reason for why the police find them. Like, they find the artwork walking down the street by itself.
Right. Looking kind of lost, out of place.
Right. But it has somebody's luggage tag on it, missing, who's mysteriously attached to it somehow. Right. Well, are you working on anything now?
I'm working on a couple of things. I just finished up a goofy little thing when I was teaching this class, I was trying to get the students to do stuff that they've never done before. So I took a survey to find out. And if somebody was real comfortable with wood, I'd make them work with macaroni.
Right.
If somebody was real comfortable with steel, I would say, here's some cotton ball. Or just something totally out of the realm, because my philosophy is this is the time to screw up.
Yeah.
If you're going to screw up now, especially in my class where it's like, you're really, really going to have to screw up to fail. And I would rather you come in, busted your butt to do something and have a complete failure, because the whole process is about learning. So I said, I'm gonna do the same thing. So I'm gonna give myself something to do. So I had to do an object that was static, and was using a lot of mold making and plastic casting stuff, which I hadn't much experience with. So I ended up making this little duck mannequin figure thing, and it turned out great. But it goes right into my curio cabinet because it's not
right.
It's not. I don't know. I mean. Anyway, so I finished up that, and then I've been making...
Because you can't use it for duck hunting, obviously.
No.
There's no duck in the world's going to be
No, they're not fooled by this thing. A duck with human ears doesn't really fly. But I wanted to make a crowd of... Oh, I'm calling them sheep, and it's a crowd of little heads that look around. And what I started out was I wanted to do multiples. But, it's taking a lot longer, a year. I mean, they're small, but... If there's 25, and they're not terribly complex little machines, but, every time you drill a hole, you realize you got to do this 25 more times in the same place. You have to build a jig and da-da-da-da. And it's it can be very boring to cast, 25 of this, 25 of that, get them together, glue them. Each one has to be the same.
Right.
So eventually what I want is a crowd of small objects responding to something. But so they're sheep, and it is about as political as I'll ever get, but they all have this sort of slightly startled look to them, and they're just responding to, I don't know what they're going to respond to yet. They could be a sound.
A George Bush doll?
Oh, I mean, it was all I was thinking about. They'd kind of be at a drive-in. You have a flat panel monitor, and he would come on the screen, and they'd all kind of whoa, But it was the idea. It was also to create an art toy, but then I started realizing it would be cool to have a crowd and in a large room. Because I mean, I, you know, I feel like if, like in a large room, if you have one piece, it's a very powerful moment. And or you have these things in corners where people would discover it, because that's another way I like to display the work is, you know, if you're in a big crowded group show or something, I usually take my work and shove it in the corner. Mm-hmm. And it's a, you know, so somebody, it's a real personal experience about discovering it. Like people say, I didn't see your work at the show. And somebody will say, oh, I found it. Uh-huh. And that's a real important moment because it's a real – I don't want it to be like this group experience. I want it to be a solo experience because that I find it has a larger impact. And that's how I like to discover stuff, you know.
What do you see your future as an artist?
Oh, God. I don't know. That's a really – at this point. Ask me on different days, I'll give you different answers.
Yeah, that's probably a good answer. Not really. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, right now I'm terrified, so it's a really stressful question a lot of times. I don't know. You know, I used to think that where I'm at now was the sign of failure.
Which is making work that's not selling.
Making work that's not selling. I'm not the art star I wanted to be,
right,
and not
right.
All these things that I thought
were going to
and
happen.
I would look at somebody when I was in my mid to late 20s mm-hmm. who was 40 years old and mm-hmm. you know, excited to show at the Jewish Community Center as a loser.
As a loser.
But I mean, I've beaten a lot of odds in many ways, and so in terms of, like, I still make work years afterwards, it's still paramount to whatever decision I make. It comes back to, it really just comes back to, I like to make stuff.
Yeah.
And that sort will of never where we disappear. Started.
It's exactly where we started.
Right.
First thing almost you said was, I like to make stuff. And I think that's a wonderful way to end. I mean, there really is no answer for most of the questions I'm asking you. You know that, I know that. Well, I'm afraid we're about out of time. I want to thank you all for tuning in to Zero Hour. I hope you've enjoyed our lunch together. We look forward to seeing you again on the radio next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WR.